let's give a warm welcome to our keynote speaker, New York Times bestselling author, John Acuff.
I need to start with a quick confession. Here's my confession. I am a goal nerd. I love goals. 1 year I read 100 books. 1 year I ran 1,000 miles. 1 year I hired a ping pong coach because I wanted to get better at table tennis. Raise your hand if you've done that goal in the room. Anybody else? Hire an elderly man from mainland China to throw hundreds of ping pong balls at you in a rental property while yelling, kill, kill, kill. No? I was worried about that. I love goals. I write books about goals. I tweet about goals. I even have a podcast called All It Takes Is a Goal where I interview people about the goals they're working on. One of my favorite interviews this year was with Greg Sankey. He's the SEC commissioner. And when I say SEC, I mean football, not finances. And I asked him, what was it like to lead through COVID? Because the entire sporting world internationally was watching to see if the SEC was going to play football games again. And it was fascinating. What was interesting was during the week that Texas joined the SEC, which was a $1 billion negotiation, he sent me a thank you note for being on the podcast. And I said to my wife, isn't it amazing that a guy at his level still sends thank you notes? And she said, oh no, you got it backwards. He's at that level because he sends thank you notes, because communication matters. And God bless a spouse that'll clarify things for you. One of my things my wife will say when she reads one of my books when it's in manuscript form is she'll come into my office and she'll say, hey, do you want feedback or compliments? That's a good communication question. Because sometimes I just want her to be like, you're fine, it'll work out. You've got good words in your head. But I love goals. I love writing about them. I love podcasting about them. And the reason why is simple. A goal is the fastest path between where you are today and where you want to be tomorrow. But there's a problem. And here's the problem with goals. Starting is fun, but the future belongs to finishers. Everybody starts. We all start. We have these exciting things we're going to do, but it's really, really hard to finish. And so I've been studying goals for the last 12 years. What does it take to go from being a chronic starter to a consistent finisher? How do we actually finish the things that matter to us? And I started to notice that mindset mattered more than anybody else was talking about. And not just mindset in a general sense. There was one part of mindset that was getting in the way the most, and it's overthinking. Overthinking was wrecking goals. And I'll give you a few examples of overthinking. Have you ever told yourself an elaborate story about why somebody didn't text you back? So you texted them, and then you waited, and they didn't respond. Or worse, they sent the bubbles, but then they pulled it back. And you know nobody pulls back a compliment, right? Nobody goes, I was going to say you're so pretty, but never mind. I was going to say I love your communication strategy, but never mind. And you start to tell yourself this elaborate story. Could they be mad? Could they have misinterpreted what I said? Should I have used more exclamations to show I'm excited? If I use as many exclamations in real conversations as I do in text messages, I would be screaming at your face constantly. That's overthinking. Here's another example. Have you ever reread an email you already sent? So you sent something out. Maybe it's three people, maybe it's the entire company. And then an hour later, a day later, maybe even a week later, you go into your sent email folder and reread that. That thing is gone. You can't do anything. That's overthinking. How about this? Have you ever self-edited an idea before it even left your head? Before you even wrote it down on a piece of paper or into your laptop, you said, no, That's too dumb. No, nobody would go for that. No, I don't need to do that. And you self-edited. Can you imagine the communication ideas we've lost? The business ideas, the works of art, the cures for diseases we've lost because somebody self-edited before they wrote it down? That's overthinking. And it's not just something that individuals do. Companies do it too. I would say it's the most expensive things companies invest in every year without even knowing. It complicates systems. It slows decisions. It makes you miss opportunities. And it's not a personality trait. It's the sneakiest, greediest form of fear because it steals from us. It steals our time, our creativity, and our productivity. But let's get a definition of overthinking so we can actually deal with it. Here's how I define it. Overthinking is when what you think gets in the way of what you want. You have a plan. You have a vision. You know where you're headed. And then all these thoughts get in the way of that. But is it really that big of an issue? I was curious about that. So I did what I always do when I get curious. I commissioned a research study. with a PhD named Mike Peasley. And he and I asked 10,000 people if they struggle with overthinking. 10,000 people. The reason we asked that many was that we wanted a huge sample size. Most of the time when you read an article that says, you know, 50% of Republicans, 50% of Democrats, if you actually click on the tweet and read the article at the bottom, it says, we asked 11 people. Four of them were named Larry. So we wanted a big sample size. So we asked 10,000 people, do you struggle with overthinking? And more than 99.5% of people said yes. Now, this was surprising because we did the study in 2019. We did the study before the pandemic. The pandemic 2020 was catnip for overthinking. If you aren't overthinking then, you are now, right? I mean, for the first time, your leader said to you, hey, will you write up some really good communication piece to convince people to come to work? Did you figure, you never had to market work. You never had to do a marketing campaign for the office. And then you were like, okay, we'll talk about like the sunlight here is really nice. We have coffee. Like we'll add a pickleball court in the parking lot. You never once had to market the office in 2018. And then all of a sudden people are like, nah, I don't come in buildings anymore. And then your CEO was like, hey, will you fix that with like a cool email? And you're like, no problem. I'll just change the entire power shift of employment that happened in the last 2 years with my words. There's a lot of overthinking happening right now. And part of the reason is this, everything is a thing. Everything is a thing. Every part of your life because of the pandemic has extra layers of thoughts on it. I thought about that a few months ago. I was at an event and somebody went to shake my hand. And right before they shook my hand, I thought, should I refuse? And then I thought, well, maybe I'll, like, what about a fist bump? Do we have any data that the fist bump is scientifically safer than that? What if I twisted the hips because the hips don't lie and give them an elbow? Like, remember when we went through the elbow phase? And then I was like, what if I shake their hand, but then I immediately put my entire arm up to the elbow into a vat of hand sanitizer as if to say, excuse me 1 second while I scrub off this deadly pandemic you just tried to murder me and my grandparents with. Just 1 second. You ever meet somebody and they swab down right after they met you? They're like, oh, hold on a second. Filth, you look filthy. You look, I'm going to roll up the sleeves on this one. And then I started looking around the room and I was like, are other people shaking hands here? What does that say about us politically? What does that say about who we voted for? Do you know what I thought about 3 years ago when somebody tried to shake my hand? Nothing. I shook their hand. But now everything has extra layers of thought. Same with the grocery store. First 99% of your life, you were amazing at the grocery store. You never once paused and were like, okay, is this an up aisle or a down aisle? I don't want to mess up this grocery store run and get publicly shamed by my neighbors. Which direction on this chip aisle? You were so good at the grocery store. But then now everything has extra layers of thought. So I started to study mindset and overthinking. I was surprised how many resources would just say, stop it. Just stop overthinking. Stop thinking. Number one, that's impossible. You're designed to think. I love meditation, quiet time, whatever phrase you want. That's 10 minutes of your day. That's 30 minutes. What about the other 23 and a half hours of the day? It's impossible to stop thinking. And the second thing is, wouldn't it make more sense to just think thoughts that helped us? Thoughts that encouraged us? You see, you and I have the great benefit of growing up in the age of neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is this fairly recent science that says your thoughts are so powerful, they can change the physical structure of your brain. That's how powerful your thoughts are. They can rewire your physical structure of your brain. Neuroplasticity shows us that. Our generation knows that. Our parents' generation didn't know about neuroplasticity. Their parents' generation thought it was good to smoke cigarettes during the Tour de France. That's a true story. In the 1920s, cyclists would smoke during the race because they thought the nicotine opened the capillaries in their lungs. Can you imagine that today in 2022? Someone going, hey, I got a huge mountain here in France. Hit me with a lucky strike. No filter. Filters are for wusses. Give it to me raw. Every generation learns something new, and we're learning about mindset. And here's what it means. If you can worry, you can wonder. If you can spin, you can soar. If you can doubt, you can dominate. What if you could have all those thoughts work for you, not against you? You can. And all it takes is a soundtrack. And a soundtrack is just my phrase for a repetitive thought. I've heard people say, a thought is like a leaf on a river. It's a cloud in the sky, it's a car on the highway, but for me, it's a soundtrack because a soundtrack has the power to change an entire moment, and often we don't even notice it's happening. Like, think about a movie that opens up on a little house, white picket fence, maybe some kids frolicking, And then they change the soundtrack to something ominous. It changes everything, right? Suddenly you go, hey, don't go in that house. It's quiet. It's too quiet. There could be a creepy clown in that sewer. What if they play a happy song? What if they play Vanessa Carlton's Thousand Miles? Suddenly somebody's making their way downtown. Suddenly it's a rom-com. The soundtrack changes everything. And the thoughts you listen to again and again and again become added to your personal playlist. They become part of what you believe about the world. You have a soundtrack for every job you've ever had. You have a soundtrack for every coworker, for every relationship, for every city you've ever lived in. We're built of soundtracks. Same with companies. That's all culture is. Culture is just a collection of soundtracks playing consistently at a company. Things that the team decided to believe. Now, how powerful are they? My favorite example, favorite study was at NYU. A few years ago, NYU did a study where they brought college students in. They said, hey, we want you to make sentences out of this word bank. They gave them a bunch of words. To the first group, they said, here's your words, make some sentences. To the second group, same instructions, but in their collection of words, they had hidden words related to being old. Words like slow and retired and bald and even Florida. That was one of the words. You know your state has a lot of elderly in it when it's used as a communication tool to trigger people in a scientific study. And so they give them this assignment, and then 20 minutes later, they go, hey, the second part of the test is down the hall. Will you please walk down there? And that's when the real test started, because the scientists secretly timed how long it took them to walk to the end of the hall. And the students who had unknowingly read the words about being old physically acted old. Just reading words about being old made them walk slower down the hall. That's how powerful your thoughts are, which is actually great news for us as communicators. Because here's what it means. Great thoughts lead to great actions. Great actions lead to great results. And all too often, we have leaders that go, here's the results we want, here's the results we want, but they never change the first part, they never change the communication, they never change the thoughts that are driving everything, and they never get the results. And you're at the forefront of that. I feel like the rest of the world just discovered your job in the last 2 years. Like, they just like, hey, it turns out that how we talk to people really matters. And then you have to pretend like that's news to you too, because you can't just be like, well, duh. But every company I talk to is having the same conversation. How do we communicate with our people? How do we talk to them? It turns out they're whole humans. Like, people were struggling with stuff. They've got like lives outside of the building. I'm like, you don't say. And they're leaning into what your industry does, what you do, which is great news. So what do we do with that? Well, there's three things we do. Three things that great companies, great leaders do when it comes to mindset and communication. Number one, they retire the broken soundtracks. They identify what's in the way, what's holding us back. What are our broken soundtracks in our culture, in our team? The second thing they do, they replace them with new soundtracks. Your brain wants to think. Your brain is waiting to be told. You can't just stop thinking. Your brain is saying, okay, well, what do you want to think instead? And you replace them. You're deliberate. And then the third thing, you repeat them so often, they become as automatic as the old ones. You retire, you replace, you repeat. So how do we do that? Well, let's talk about those three different things. The first one, retire. Let's start with some examples of some broken soundtracks that maybe you've experienced. Here's a really common one. That's not how we do things here. It's not how we do things here. I've heard this one hundreds of times in the last 2 years. A lot of sales teams, when I work with sales teams, they'll say, John, you know, I'm an in-the-room guy. Or I'm the queen of coffee drop-off. I like to visit all my accounts. I bring donuts. I bring coffee. Get me in the room. I can close the room. And all of a sudden, the room was off limits. All of a sudden, they had to try to sell over WebEx or Teams or Zoom. And they say, I can't do this. This is not how we do things here. And that became a broken soundtrack. Here's another one. There's never been a day that turned out the way it was scheduled. So why do we talk about the schedule? I heard this one from a big dental practice, multi-million dollar dental practice, and all the hygienists were saying this because they would come up with this plan and then they couldn't plan for an 8-year-old to chip his tooth at a baseball game and the whole rest of the day to go sideways. And they were frustrated. Here's another common one. We never reach our goals, so why do we set them? This is a soundtrack of apathy. Why bother? We never hit our goals. Why bother? Now, if you want to identify if you have a soundtrack, a broken soundtrack in your own life, I'll give you a 30-second exercise you can do later today. It's really, really simple. All you do is write down a goal. Write down a goal, any goal. It could be, I want to start a podcast. I want to write a book. I want to lose 10 pounds. I want to run a 5K. I want to get a promotion. I want to do a better job with the CFO relationship I have. It can be anything. Write down a goal and then listen to your first thoughts. Listen to your reaction, because every reaction is an education. What's your reaction? Is your reaction, I can do that, I should do that, it's time to do that, I'm equipped to do that, or is it negative? Is it, who are you to think you could do that? That'll never work. It's never worked in the past, it won't work again. Now, what's interesting is fear argues both sides of the coin. When you're in your 20s and 30s, fear goes, you're too young. You're too young, you don't have enough experience. You're too young. Then you hit your 40s and 50s and fear goes, it's too late. You missed your shot. You missed your window. You're out of touch. And you want to say to fear, when was I the perfect age to do this? As if fear will go, there were 10 minutes when you were 31. It was a Tuesday in October. It would have been chef's kiss, so perfect. So figure that out. If you want to find out if you have a broken soundtrack, that's all you do. And then you take the loudest ones and you ask them three questions. Not all your thoughts. You have 60,000 thoughts a day. Who has time for that? You take the loudest ones, the ones that are hurting your team, that are hurting your company, that are hurting you individually, and you ask three questions. Now, these are Trojan horse questions. I'm going to show you them, and you're not going to be amazed by the words. You will have seen the words before. But they're Trojan horse because if you sit with them, you'll discover something really interesting about yourself and your team and your culture. First question, is it true? Is it true? Is the thing I'm telling myself about myself true? Is the thing I'm telling myself about our company true? Is the thing I'm telling myself about our team true? One of the greatest mistakes you can make is assuming all your thoughts are true. And the reason you do you know why you assume all your thoughts are true? Is because they're delivered in the voice you've heard the most in your entire life. Every thought you've ever had is delivered in your voice, so we tend to trust that voice. Even though your thoughts have lied to you again and again and again, you ever had a moment where your thoughts go, oh, that person is so mad. That executive is so mad. They're so mad. And then you go interact with them and you realize they weren't mad at all. You never go back to your thoughts and go, you got me on that one. Next time, though, I'm not going to trust you so quickly. No, we assume our thoughts are true. And I love this first question because it's really powerful. One of my favorite people in the research study we did was a guy named Sal St. Germain. And his team in Hawaii felt stuck. He was part of a small team. They had a big company kind of structure above them. And they were saying what a lot of teams will say. They're holding us back. They're handcuffing us. The suits don't understand our local market. All these kind of broken soundtracks that are really common in big teams and big structures. And Sal decided to ask, I'm going to see if that's true. He said, I'm going to go ask if that's true. So he went to his manager. And he said, hey, here's what the team is saying. Here's the broken soundtracks that we're repeating. Is it true? Are you holding us back? And his manager was shocked. His manager said, no, what are you talking about? Our job is to equip and empower you. We're waiting for you to tell us what you need so we can help you go faster in your market. We look to you as the local experts. And Sal said, knowing that changes from being a team of victims into a team of partners. And it changed everything. And that's a nice story. I mean, they get a new thought. That's nice. But again, our goal isn't just new thoughts. Our goal is new thoughts that lead to new actions, and new actions lead to new results. So I said to Sal, did that really change anything results-wise? And he said, well, knowing that information allowed us to save $14 million over the next 5 years. So yes, it was a valuable three words to ask. That's what I mean when I say companies overinvest and overthinking without even knowing. I shared this idea with the CEO of Hyatt Hotels, and he said, we've modified it. We add the word still. Is it still true? Because what was true last week might not be true this week because things are changing so quickly. So we say, is it still true? That's the first question. Second question is this. Is it helpful? Is it helpful? When we repeat this as a team again and again and again, is it helpful? Does it push us forward or pull us back? Now, sometimes the pushback I get to overthinking is people say, well, I'm not an overthinker. I just like to be detailed. I like to be analytical. I'm into logistics. And you should be all of those things. I love those things. I spoke to a big trucking company recently. They're into logistics. You should be prepared. You should be detailed. But let me show you the difference between preparedness and overthinking. Preparedness always leads to action. There is a trail of actions. You ship. You finish. You launch. Overthinking always leads to overthinking. Now, the reason you have to ask more than one question is because there are some things in life that are true, but not helpful. For example, I interviewed a manager and he said, John, 12 years ago, I got fired from my job. I've been fired before, not a great experience. And he said, 12 years later, I noticed that anytime there was a door closed on a meeting that I wasn't invited into, I started to overthink that. I started to go, why am I not in that meeting? Should I be in that meeting? Who's in that meeting? What's the agenda of that meeting? Are there powerful people in that meeting? Let's say he only does that 10 minutes a day. One day, like 5 days a week. What's the big deal, right? 50 minutes? Well, the big deal is that over a 12-year period, that equates to 62 8-hour work days. Is that a valuable thing for him to donate time to? Of course not. Now, is it true he could be fired? It is. It's true of all of us. But is it helpful for him to repeat that again and again and again? Of course not. Another broken soundtrack I've been hearing a lot lately is it's impossible to hire. It's impossible to hire. And it is challenging to hire. Like, I don't know where everybody is. Like, I've been thinking about that. Because every restaurant I go into has signs that are like, please don't punch the staff that showed up today. And like every executive I talk to goes, I worked with a team the other day. They said, we do 4 people for our 1 interview slot because we're going to get ghosted on 3 of them. And we know that ahead of time. Where is everybody? Like, I feel like there's this unemployed Coachella somewhere where like 50 million people are just dancing in a field, not working. Because I know they didn't leave. Like, come back. Has anybody checked Kansas? Like, has anybody... But is it helpful for your team to make that the drumbeat? That it's impossible to hire, it's impossible to hire, it's impossible. Does that send them encouraging communication? Of course not. So you have to ask 2 questions, and then you get to the third. Here's the third question, is it kind? This is my favorite question to ask, because when I share it with high-performing rooms, which, by the way, you're all high performers, and I know that because low performers don't attend events like this. They don't even know they exist. Like, you're here voluntarily. Like, this is a lot of you are taking notes. You're a high performer. But when I share this question with high performers, I can feel them go, oh, here we go. It feels soft, like fuzzy. It feels like I'm gonna be like, you gotta hug 4 people before you leave the room. Or like, we're gonna get in a drum circle in Malibu and light a sprig of sage with this question. So I always pull it back to science. Let's pull it back. A few years ago, Google wondered something. They wondered, what do our most successful teams have in common? It's a great question, right? Some of our teams are killing it. Some of them aren't. Could we figure out what the best teams have in common and then teach that to the other teams? So they launched something called Project Aristotle. Project Aristotle did 3 things. Number 1, spent millions of dollars. Number 2, measured 180 different teams. And number 3, used 35 different statistical models to answer that question. And what they found was the number 1 most important thing that all the successful teams had in common was something called psychological safety. What's psychological safety? Well, here's how Amy Edmondson defines it. It's a shared belief held by members of a team that the team is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. But what does that mean on a Tuesday? What does that mean on a Thursday? Because that's what I'm always trying to get to. I'm always going, okay, you leave this space and you have a real Thursday with real challenges. How do you execute this in the real world? What it means is, on great teams, you can do 3 things. You can ask questions, you can suggest new ideas, and you can admit you are wrong, and then here's the kicker, without being treated unkindly by the team. Now, why do those 3 things matter? Well, if you can't ask questions, learning is over. If you can't raise your hand and go, I don't understand that, can you explain it? Hey, could you give me some more clarity on that? If you can't do that, learning in your environment is over. If you can't suggest new ideas, innovation is over. You never want teams leaving the best part of themselves in the parking lot before they come into your space. And if you can't admit you are wrong, you're doomed to repeat the same mistakes you already made. You only get to fix the mistakes that you admit. And leaders have to be able to do that. Like, what I've learned over the years is leaders who can't be questioned end up doing questionable things. Let me say that again. Leaders who can't be questioned end up doing questionable things. Show me a team that fell. Show me a company fell. Show me a church that fell. I'll show you a leader who is isolated and could only be told the things that he or she wanted to hear because they didn't have psychological safety. So what's a simple soundtrack switch we could make in regards to this idea? Well, what if you stopped saying that'll never work here and started saying, I wonder how that could work here. I wonder. The words aren't that different, but the experience is very different. I actually learned this one the hard way. I was on a flight to Portland, Oregon to speak at an event, and I was sitting next to a photographer named Jeremy Cowart. And Jeremy Cowart is one of the world's most successful photographers. Forbes, Huffington Post, Yahoo. They all named him the most influential photographer on the internet. And he's done everything. He's taken portraits of Taylor Swift to photos of Rwandan tribes that are reconciling after genocide. He's presented at the UN. He's done everything. We're sitting on this flight because we were both speaking at this event called the World Domination Summit, which sounds like where dictators go get soft skills, but it's actually just a tech conference with a funny name. And so I said to him, hey, what are you excited about right now? What are you working on? Because I love asking questions. You're communicators. Like, I'm a journalism major. There's a lot of journalism majors in here. Like, I love asking questions that start conversations. One of my favorite ones, this is just a bonus, is if you ever have to valet your car at a hotel or a restaurant, ask that kid, what's the coolest car you parked this month? That kid's face will light up. You go, oh, there was a Lamborghini in here last week. I drove it 4 feet. It was amazing. But I said to him, what are you excited about? And he said, well, I actually want to do a hotel. He said, I want to do something called the Purpose Hotel, where every inch of it changes the world, where every room sponsors a kid that's hungry. Every lobby has a charity water well in it, that the soaps are sustainable. And then he paused and he got quiet. And he did that thing when people tell you something they care about, they pause to see your reaction. Every coworker you have does that pause. If you're married, your spouse does that pause. If you have kids, your kids do that pause. And he paused, and I'd love to tell you that my reaction was positive and encouraging, but that would be a very big lie, because my face was like, ugh. And my words were like, a whole hotel? I mean, it's so much bigger than a camera. It feels real. Are you sure you can do a hotel? And years later, he would say how disappointing that was to him and how crushing that was to him. And you know who didn't react that way? Horst Schulze, the co-creator of the Ritz-Carlton. He's working on that hotel with Jeremy Cowart right now in Nashville. So I decided I don't want to be the type of communicator. I don't want to be the type of leader who people can't bring new ideas to. So I needed a new soundtrack. Here's what I came up with. Curiosity beats criticism. Curiosity beats criticism. Now, I'm not saying every idea is amazing. It's not. But at the beginning of ideas, curiosity beats criticism. There's plenty of time later to poke holes in it, especially when you're in an innovation year, and you're in an innovation year, by the way. We're all rookies at this year. No one in here, if I said, hey, raise your hand if this is your 10th global pandemic you've recovered from. No one would be like, it is. It's actually kind of boring to me. I'm so used to this. No, we're all rookies at this year, and in years where there's lots of innovation, curiosity beats criticism. So if you can't answer yes to those three questions, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? It might be a broken soundtrack. You need to retire. Which brings us to our second step, replace. Now, this one was interesting because if I say to teams, hey, what are your broken soundtracks? What are the things that are getting in the way? They can usually come up with them. Or if I say to individuals, what are the negative thoughts you think are holding you back? They can come up with them. But then if I flip it and go, what would you like to think instead? If you could have any thoughts playing at any time instead, they meet with a blank face. They go, I've never thought about it that way. Because most of us aren't taught that we can change how we think. I mean, think about how we talk about it. We say, she got carried away by her thoughts. He got lost in his thoughts, as if thoughts are something outside of us. Even my most type A friends who lay out their clothes the night before they go to the gym, because it means they'll go to the gym, they don't pick their thoughts ahead of time. Very rarely do I meet leaders who go, I've got a big negotiation on Thursday, and I had one go south a week ago. I don't want to bring those broken soundtracks into this one. So here's the three soundtracks I'm going to have on repeat when I walk in that room. Like, I'm going to pick those. Most people don't do that, which is a shame, because thoughts come by one of two ways, choice or chance. You choose them ahead of time and say, here's my soundtrack, or you chance them. And great communicators, great leaders choose their thoughts. And they're always actionable. We're always leaning towards action, especially in the context of business. So how do we do that? How do we choose our thoughts? How do we replace? Well, it's pretty simple. You take out your calendar. You ask one question. Where do I want to win this week? Next 7 days, where do I want to win? If thoughts turn into actions and actions turn into results, where do I want to win? Where do I want some results? And when you do that, you'll notice your calendar is built off of two things. Everybody's calendar in this room has two things in it: people and projects. That's roughly what your entire week is. So let's start with people. You have a soundtrack for every person in your life. And I know this because you have somebody in your phone that just seeing their name on notifications sets you off. You know you do. Like, you don't even have to read the text. You go, oh, here we go, Sheila. Right now, you're thinking of that person. Like, some of y'all are like, it's Mike. He's talking about Mike. He's texted us 50 times from the office. We've been gone for like 36 hours. You know exactly who I'm talking about. So what do we do with that? If we see that we've got a meeting coming up with them, if we see that we want a better relationship with them, what's a soundtrack we can replace some of those broken ones with? One of my favorite soundtracks is empathy. You talk about the science of engagement. Empathy is all through engagement, right? And here's how I define it. It's two parts. It's understanding what someone needs and acting on it. It's two parts. You have to understand what they need and then actually do it. If you want to enrage somebody, let them know you know what they need and then don't do anything. So how do we do that? What's a practical way we can do that? Well, here's really a simple way to have empathy. Care about what the people you care about care about. Care about what the people you care about care about. I learned that from a chimney sweep. I don't know if you knew they have these. They have these big events for chimney sweeps, and they bring speakers sometimes. And about a month before I got there, we had a phone call, and I promise you they told me this. This isn't like speaker stick. They said, John, whatever you do from stage, whatever you do at the chimney sweep event, do not mention Mary Poppins. They actually said that. And that was good information for me because I thought Mary Poppins was their Michael Jordan. But it turns out chimney sweeps are chim-chimneyed out of that woman. They want no part of that woman. So I go to this event and I speak, and after, a chimney sweep comes up to me and he goes, hey, I've been having troubles with my business. Like, a big part of being a chimney sweep is doing an annual cleaning. You clean somebody's chimney. You clean all the creosote out so it doesn't start a fire. I grew up in Massachusetts. We had to do that once a year. He said I'd send direct mail, postcards, text messages. I'd communicate as much as I could, and nobody would schedule a cleaning. And then the first cold weekend of the year, everyone would call me, and I couldn't service them all. And he said, because nobody was thinking about their annual cleaning. And that's true of every business, by the way. There's not a single one of your coworkers or customers that are somewhere right now going, I can't wait to see what they learned. Oh, I can't wait to see what they learned in Chicago. No, it's not their job to think about us. It's our job to think about them. And so he decided, I'm going to try to see what people care about. And he realized that for some reason, a lot of his customers were dog owners. For whatever reason, a lot of the people that he regularly saw were dog owners. So he decided, if I'm at somebody's house and the dog is out and the dog is friendly, I'm going to pet the dog. I'm going to ask what the dog's name is. I'm even going to take a photo of the dog. And he did that. And then he had an app on his phone that would turn photos into postcards. And the day after his visit, he'd send a postcard with the picture of the dog, and in the corner would be the dog's name, the chimney sweep's name, the date of their next appointment, and his URL and cell phone. He said, John, do you know where dog owners put photos of their dogs when you send them one? On the fridge. He said, do you know how many other chimney ads people put on the fridge? Nobody does that. Nobody's like, oh, chimney times is here? Clear the kids' report cards. My daddy was a chimney man. I'm a chimney man. It changed his business having a little bit of empathy. So the question you need to ask for yourself is, what do the people you care about? What do they care about? That's how you engage. And this question is really powerful right now. And the reason why is that crisis magnifies kindness. The things you do for people are worth 100 times what they were 3 years ago because of the crisis we've all just been through. Little things have tremendous weight. I was reminded of this on a trail run. I went on this big trail run, and I passed this elderly gentleman that I'd seen the day before, and this time when I passed him, he did this. He gave me a double thumbs up, and that made my day. I told my wife about it when I got home. I'm telling you about it. 3 years ago, before the pandemic, a random old man in the woods gives me a double thumbs up. I'm probably like, it's too many thumbs, sir. One would have sufficed. This is extravagant. The little things you do right now for people have tremendous weight. The way you communicate, the way you remember. You want to blow somebody's mind? All it takes is 30 seconds. When somebody you work with, somebody you report to, whatever, tells you something that's important to them and it's date related, put it down in your phone the day after and ask them how it went. When they say, hey, this Thursday, we're dropping off our first kid at college. There's a lot of pressure. I'm sorry if I seem distracted. Like, oh, you know. They're going to make offhand comments. The leaders you talk with are going to make offhand comments like that. On Friday, text them and go, how did the drop-off go? You know what they're going to say? Thank you for thinking of me. Thank you for thinking of me. It's little things. So how do we have empathy? What does it really mean for us to have empathy? I'll give you the 6-word formula. It's very simple. Read less minds, ask more questions. Read less minds, ask more questions. Now, everyone in here who's a writer, because there's a lot of writers, I know it should technically be fewer minds. Some of y'all just went, ugh. But less was a better rhythm, and rhythm is a dancer, so I went with less, and I feel fine. I feel fine about that decision, but some of y'all's ears just went, I can't, this slide is killing me. But have you ever had a meeting where the team brainstorms something for 8 hours, 6 hours, and at the end of the meeting, somebody annoying raises their hand and goes, hey, did we ask anybody if they want this thing we're doing? Like, did we talk to any customers or stakeholders or any, like, did we ask anybody if they wanted? They're like, no, why'd we do that? Let's just spend a lot of time, a lot of money. Launch it and be surprised nobody wants it. What I've learned over the years is it's better to meet a need than invent a need. It's really expensive and time consuming to invent a need. It's really fun when you meet needs. I learned that lesson working for Bose. I worked at Bose, the stereo company outside of Framingham, Massachusetts, about 23 years ago. They make high-end headphones, home theater systems. And 1 year, we had a problem. And our problem was we created a new system for gigging musicians. When I say gigging musicians, I mean singer-songwriters that are carrying their gear from smoky bar to smoky bar. They have to bring their own speaker system. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. Our demographics, population-wise, are 90% musicians, 10% bachelorette parties. That's our breakdown. Like if your city is void of bachelorette parties right now, don't worry, they're in Nashville. They're safe. They're all wearing the same thing, cowboy boots, cowboy hat, jean shorts, shirt that rhymes frisky with whiskey in a playful fashion. Pedal Tavern should pick up at our airport in the taxi line so you can start scream singing Red Solo Cup as soon as you get to Nashville. But we had this system for gigging musicians, and the problem was either they didn't know who we were, they'd never heard of Bose, or they knew who we were and they didn't like us. They said, you're sterile, you're classical music, you're scientific, you're boring, you don't understand me like Fender. Other brands understand me. Now, we could have pretended. We could have Googled some words that they say and put them in our marketing or our communications. That's tempting as a dad of teenage daughters. I have two teenage daughters. It's tempting to look up words kids say and then slide them into conversation. Like, what's the deal with Lady Zsa Zsa? Is she still fat with a pH? Oh, didn't mean to be so lit. That's so mid. I'm savage. Don't crease the J's. I know what that means too. Like, it's tempting to do that, but people can tell when you've done that. The people you communicate, they can tell when you're communicating to them versus with them. And so fortunately, Bose didn't do that. We did something called Bose Bandcamp. We brought in musicians from around the country and said, use the gear, tell us what works, tell us what doesn't. And we discovered things we never could have guessed on our own. My favorite example, we had a musician say, hey, will you please not put the name Bose on the bag the year comes in? Will you please not put the name Bose on the outside? And we were gonna put it in like 1,000-point corporate font, like Bose. And we said, why wouldn't we put our own name on our own bag? And he said, well, when you do that, people at nightclubs know my gear's expensive. People at airports know my gear's expensive and they steal it. So you can put your name on the bag, but I'm gonna do what I always do, which is cover it with tape, or you can just meet my need. And we never would have gotten to that understanding unless we asked questions, unless we were in the trenches. And we had to figure that out. And there are other times where we missed it. We missed it on headphones. We're used to the idea now that people spend $300, $400, $500 on consumer headphones, but 23 years ago, nobody was doing that. But then somebody at Bose had a really smart idea. They said, you know, we have an acoustic noise canceling system for pilots. We're selling the first two seats of the plane. Could we create a consumer version and sell the other 180 seats on the plane? It was a brilliant business idea and it worked. And we were crushing. But then consumers started to change what they want. They started to say, hey, we love the sound quality, but we care about how they look too. Could we have different designs, different colors? Sometimes we wear the headphones to match our shoes. And Bose ignored that. We ignored that consumer change. You know who listened to that consumer change? You know who didn't ignore that? Dr. Dre and Beats. And they ate our lunch at a multi-billion dollar industry. We broke the first rule of electronics. We forgot about Dre. And our... and our attitude was kind of like, what do you mean we don't have colors? We have colors. Dark gray, off gray, light gray. Here are your colors. I wore Bose headphones yesterday on the flight. I'll wear them today in like 3 hours. When I went to buy them, I had two color options, silver and black. That's a very skinny rainbow. It's a very skinny rainbow. We missed it, and you'll miss it too. And here's what you know as communicators more than anybody else. When you ask somebody what they need, they become visible and valuable. That's what every employee you're communicating wants to know. Do you see me? Do I matter? Do you see me? Do I matter? So you replace the broken soundtracks with one of empathy. But what about projects? We talked about there's two parts of your calendar. What about the project side? Because you have a soundtrack for every project in your life. Same process. Take out the calendar. Where do I want to win this week? When I asked myself this question, the answer was obvious. Maybe for you, it's data. Like all of a sudden, you have to swim through like hordes of data. So much data is now kind of inside communication. It's making communication better, but it also slows it down in some ways. And so you're trying to figure that out. Technology is changing. But you look at your calendar and go, where do I want to win? And when I asked that question, the answer was obvious. The answer was sales. I was in corporate marketing for about 15 years. And then when I started my own company, I realized, oh no, I'm also now in sales. Like I wear that hat now. And I had a lot of broken soundtracks about sales. One of my broken soundtracks was, if you keep talking about what you do, people will be bothered. People will be frustrated. People will be angry. And I had to say, is that true? Am I ever angry when somebody sells me something I need or want? And the answer is I'm not. Like, I'm never mad inside an REI sporting goods store. I never walk in, I'm like, stupid paddle boards. So mad they sold me a ski coat. No, I feel the opposite. I walk in that store, I'm like, I can do any activity in the world if I have the right gear. I could get into cave diving if I had a headlamp. I love that store. I'm never mad when somebody communicates in a way that helps me with something I need or want. Another example, this is the dorkiest thing I do. One of my favorite hobbies is putting together massive Lego cars, like a 911, a Bugatti. I shared that with a client recently, and a guy in the back went, woohoo, when I said that. And you ever have a moment where you say something and you wish you could pull it back immediately? Like, as the words are dribbling out, you're like, those aren't the right words. He went, woohoo, and I immediately said, me and that guy didn't get to go to the prom. Like, it just came out. But I love putting together these big Lego cars. And I have to say cars because if I say vehicles, my wife knows it's a slippery slope to a Star Wars destroyer. So she's like, they have to be earthbound cars. That's our agreement. But I love doing it because most of my life doesn't have clear instructions. Like, how do you be a dad? How do you be a husband? How do you be a writer or an executive coach or a speaker? There's not clear instructions, but a big 4,000-piece Ferrari Lego set has this big, thick book of instructions, and I can follow it step by step, and it turns my thoughts off for a minute. Similar to some people would say knitting does that, or gardening does that. And one Christmas, we got 6 Lego catalogs in the mail, and I didn't care because I love putting together Lego sets. And so when it came to sales, I had to write myself a new soundtrack. Here's what I came up with. I'm somebody's Lego. If I do my job well, I'm somebody's Lego. If I do my job well, people are excited to find out I have a podcast. If I do my job well, companies that saw me at one event then go, hey, we want you to do what that was to our whole company. Let's go. If I do my job well, I'm somebody's Lego. So when you look at your job and you look at the parts that are challenging, maybe you need to replace some of the soundtracks, some of the thoughts that you're communicating to yourself, about the challenge. You replace them. Then the third step, we get to this one, repeat. Repeat is interesting to me because when the book came out, so the soundtrack's book came out, 48 hours after, people started to email me or DM me on Instagram and say, hey, I retired my broken soundtracks. I could figure those out. I retired them. I replaced them, but they're not working. And I would say, the book's only been out for 48 hours. I know you haven't had time yet. Because we want fast results, right? I want fast results. That's nothing to be ashamed of. But I'll meet people that'll say, John, this exercise plan isn't working for me. And I'll go, well, how long have you done it? And they'll say, 10 days. I'll say, how long did it take you to gain the weight? They'll say, 10 years. So you gave the problem 10 years to develop and the solution only 10 days? That's so unkind to yourself. Companies do that with rollouts of software. They go, we're so frustrated, they're not adapting to the software. And if you pause for a second and said, how long did we use the old software? They'll go, 8 years. How long have we used the new software? They'll say, 6 weeks. So maybe we need to give them more time to adapt, maybe our expectations. And so people would say, okay, it's not working. And I would say, well, you need to repeat, especially if the soundtracks are something you've listened to for a long time. I see this with leaders all the time. I'll work with leaders who are given bigger leadership opportunities and they'll pull back and they can't explain why they're pulling back. But often if you pull the thread, a teacher told them at 15, 16, 17, hey, you're not a natural leader. And that became a soundtrack they've listened to for 20 years of their life now. And so now they're still listening to it and they're pulling back and it's causing actions they don't even see they're doing. It takes some time. That's why repeat is so important. I'll give you an example from my own life. So a few years ago, I started an ad agency that failed tremendously. Failed in every way possible, just a mess. And we had one final big client. I had to kind of swoop in and repair the relationship as the company dissolved. Like, I didn't save the day. I just repaired what we could. And I learned a soundtrack in the moment. Here's what I learned. I can function in a crisis. It's not a bad thing. It's true. That's helpful. It's kind to me. I can function in a crisis. The first time I had my back against the wall and I could perform. But unfortunately, your thoughts don't naturally stay good. Scientists say our brain has something called a negativity bias. You're biased towards negativity. Your thoughts devolve over time unless you work on them. By the way, that's true of every part of your life. Nothing gets awesome accidentally. Nothing gets awesome accidentally. I've never met somebody who accidentally got in shape. Like they said, yeah, it was weird. I wasn't even trying to work out. I was binge watching Netflix. I looked up, I was doing burpees. I don't even remember getting off the couch. I was flipping tractor tires. I was like, where did these tires come from? Nothing gets better accidentally. Marriages don't get better accidentally. The default of marriage is to go in different directions. You have to work for a good marriage. It's the same with thoughts. Another way to say it is this: fear comes free, hope takes work. Fear comes free. Fear will find you on its own. You never have to go look for stress. You never have to go look for fear. Fear will find you in the grocery store. You ever had that moment? Like, you're buying something in the grocery store and fear is like, hey, you want to think about that stupid thing you said last week? You want to think about that mistake you made 3 years ago? That happened to me the other day. My brain was like, hey, do you remember that surprise party you ruined? And I was like, I do now. And it's true. Now, in my defense, it was a coworker and she buried the lead. Like, when you communicate a surprise party to coworkers, the subject line should be, surprise, 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 don't tell Jake, if the guy's name is Jake. But she put it in the third paragraph. Now, my mistake, I skimmed the email. I'm gonna be honest with you, skimmed it. Didn't know it was a surprise party. Saw Jake, the birthday boy, later that day. He came up to me and said, hey, what are you doing tonight? And I said, oh, I can't wait for the party. And he said, what party? And I was like, just in general. I try to have a party mindset. You never know when there's gonna be cake, am I right? Later that night, my wife and I go to the party, and I hadn't told my wife that I'd ruined the party because she didn't even know that. And we walk in, I swear to you, Kara stops the music and goes, this is John Acuff. He's the person that ruined the party. And I was like, hey, everybody. That happened 19 years ago. And my brain is like, let's think about that today. Your thoughts, if you don't tend them like a garden, go wild. And so this thought, I can function in a crisis, over time turned into I function best in a crisis. And you can see there's a subtle shift happening. And then over time, it turned to this: I need a crisis to function. I need a crisis. And you've worked with leaders like this. You ever work with a leader who's amazing at putting out fires? They're amazing at putting out fires. What happens, though, when there's not any fires? They feel worthless. Leaders don't like feeling worthless, so what do? They start a fire. Now you don't work with a leader, you work with an arsonist. You work with somebody who brings chaos, who starts crisis, because that's all they know how to do. That's the only way they know how to function. And that's where I was. This came to a head a couple years ago. I signed the biggest book contract I've ever had in my life, and my wife pulled me aside and said, this isn't working. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you're a jerk for the 2 years when you write a book, and you're a jerk for the 2 years when you sell a book. And she didn't say jerk, but I'm trying to clean this up. TBS edited for TV. We all know the word she said. And she said, I'd rather you be a happy plumber than a miserable writer. And what she was saying was that for me to do a big project like that, I had to use the fuel of crisis and chaos and stress. So I was terrible to be around because I had to stir it up. I had to self-sabotage. I had to stir it up. I had to act like we were about to lose the farm to the bank if I didn't write the best book. And you're coming out of a crisis, by the way. I've talked to companies that have said, we still have some of our people who are operating in crisis mode and they don't know how to break out of it. Like, we had to eliminate a couple positions. Now we've rehired those positions, but this one guy won't give up any of his domain because he's still in like, it's a crisis, it's a crisis, it's a crisis. That's happening right now. I had to work on that one because that one was sticky. I had to repeat for a long time. So maybe you're saying, okay, well, how do we ease into soundtracks? How do I bring this back to my team? One really easy way to ease is to start with a story. Start with a story. You're communicators. You know how to tell stories. I mean, you know this is true, that they matter, stories matter so much when it comes to soundtracks because stories are stickier than statistics. They are. No one tells statistics around a campfire, right? No one goes, on a company retreat, remember that time we raised gross overall revenue by 0.04%? Oh, that was the best. That was when I knew this company is where my heart is. That 0.04% was what really did it for me. Start with a story. I'll give you an example. Signet Jewelers is one of my clients. They own jewelry stores in every mall in America. They own stores like Kay and Zales and Jared. And they could tell people internally, we care about customers. Like, we all know the things on mugs we put. Like, I still haven't met a company that says we hate customers. I still haven't met a company that's like, ugh, customers. I'm so tired of their money. Ugh. No, every company in the world says we love customers. You can put that on a mug or you can tell a story. And one of their stories is that during COVID, a lot of people don't know, they got stuck with millions of dollars of revenue and inventory that didn't belong to them. in their safes, they had a lot of jewelry that didn't belong to them. Anyone who had purchased a ring and hadn't picked it up, anyone who had brought a wedding ring in to get cleaned and hadn't picked it up, anyone who had ordered something, they had millions of dollars of inventory that wasn't their own. And there was one woman in Temecula, California that was desperate to get her ring back. She wanted her wedding ring back. And the reason why is it was her 25th wedding anniversary and her husband had stage 4 liver cancer. And it would have been easier to not get her ring back. I mean, this is California. The regulations have regulations have regulations. But this manager fought for her. The manager had to get 19 levels of approval. State level, local level, government level, you know, city level, county level, mall level. She gets the ring. She drives the ring back herself to the woman, gives it to the woman. Woman falls to her knees, bursts into tears. That story will reverberate around the halls of Signet Jewelers for years more than we care about customers on a mug will. So you've got to be deliberate about stories. So I think there's 3 questions you need to ask. Here's the first question. Every team meeting should start with this question. What's a story you heard from our customers this week? You can say client, you can say patients, whatever word is in your industry, just switch it out. Now, the reason I say this is when you're in an innovation mode, when you're in a growth mode, when things are hustling, you'll run right by stories and not even notice them. You need to be story collectors. Part of your role as a communicator is you are the story collector. You are an archive of the stories. You notice them. You have the ability to see them, to collect them, to repeat them to a leader, to give them to a leader that's about to step on stage and go, hey, don't forget this story. But we'll forget them if we're not deliberate. I was on a call with a healthcare company and I was asking them, we had a 60-minute call before the event. And I said, hey, are there any stories from the last year that might have a soundtrack in them that we could talk about? And they all said, no, nothing's really happened. Like, no, we don't have any stories. And I kept asking the question in multiple ways. You ever do that when you're communicating? Like you start with the first version and then you change some of the words and you just try to come at it from different angles. And so minute 55 of the hour, this one woman goes, hey, I just thought about a story that might fit what you're talking about. She said, we developed this cancer medicine that saved so many lives that the people whose lives it saved got together and started a Facebook group and they pooled their money and they bought a billboard next to our corporate headquarters to thank us for saving their lives. That was a story that happened. And she was like, is that a good one? And I was like, that's amazing. You'll miss them. First question, what are the stories? You need to be a story collector because there's soundtracks there. Second question is this, what's the actual? What are the actual soundtracks that are running through your company right now? What are the actual? And you have to ask this question and you have to ask it in a way that people can tell you the truth. The fakest question asked in America right now is how was everything tonight? At restaurants across the country, you know the drill. The manager often doesn't even stop walking. They go, how was everything tonight? You have a mouthful of food. He goes, great. I had a manager come over at the end of a meal one night. He said, hey, there's 8 of you here. You ordered drinks and appetizers and entrees and desserts. Something wasn't perfect tonight. What wasn't perfect? That was a real question. He was really saying, what's the actual? So part of your job is like, okay, what are the actual soundtracks that are in our company right now? And then the third question, what's the aspirational? Where do we want to be a year from now? A year from now, what do we want to be true? What do we want the soundtracks to be in this space? Now, I'll give you some examples of companies that have great soundtracks that repeat these soundtracks again and again and again. I love starting with this one because it's from a trucking company because often we don't think a trucking company would have an amazing soundtrack, but this one does. Here's what Old Dominion Freight Line says, helping the world keep promises. If you ask them what they do? We help the world keep promises. You made a promise to a customer, we help you keep that promise. Most trucking companies say we do cross-country synergistic logistics, like a lot of words that don't mean anything. But they say, no, at the end of the day, that's what we do. We help the world keep promises. Here's another soundtrack, Match the Pace. This is one that Signet Jewelers uses because they know anyone that comes in their store has their own pace and it's their job to match that person's pace. Some people come in with a romance pace. They want to tell you the story of the engagement. They want to show you pictures of the bridesmaid's dress. They want to tell you the first song they're going to dance to. They have a romance pace. Some people come in with a speed pace. You're their last stop on a Christmas list and they want to get in and out. Some people come in with a price pace. They've been taken advantage of by other jewelry stores and it's like they've got themselves surrounded by bear traps and they're just waiting for you to step in one. Some of the negotiations you do have that feeling. You can tell. You have to match the pace. Here's another one from one of my clients, Jewelry Hotels, Heads in Beds. Heads in Beds. They measure 100 different points of data, but at the end of the day, it's about one thing. Are we getting heads in beds? Now, the other end of the luxury spectrum, remember Horst Schulze, the co-creator of the Ritz-Carlton? I did an event with him, and he told me one of their soundtracks is this, Never Point, Always Walk. Never Point. You go to Ritz-Carlton, you say, hey, where is, you know, the Starbucks? They never go. It's around that corner down those stairs. They walk you there. I spoke at an event at the Ritz-Carlton recently, and I asked the guy where the gym was because I'm ripped. And he was like, y'all can pause on the laughter. Let it sit for a minute. That was instantaneous. The denial laughter was instantaneous. But I said, hey, where's the gym? And he started walking around to walk me. Then I was like, you're doing the thing. You're doing the slide. He seemed really confused why I was so excited. But he was living their soundtrack. And the last one, Ortho Diagnostics, healthcare company. They know in healthcare, it's really easy to see people as numbers. And so one of theirs is because every test is a life. Every test we do, there's a life attached to that. Now, what's interesting about soundtracks is once you discover the power of them, you're going to start to see them and hear them everywhere. You're going to start to notice, okay, individuals have soundtracks. They do. Couples have soundtracks. Families have soundtracks. What was interesting about this is the first book, I've written seven, where parents came out of the woodwork and said, hey, do you have a version for kids? Do you have a version for teenagers? I had parents come out of the woodwork and go, if I could have learned how to change how I think about myself as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, it would have changed the whole arc of my life. And I started to see broken soundtracks in teenagers. We had a swim meet. This girl got out of the pool and she said to her mom, I'm the slowest swimmer on the team. I'll never get better. And then she walked away. And my wife and I looked at each other and just said, oh, that's a broken soundtrack. She can change that. She can change that. And I started to see all the challenges teens face. Like Snapchat, for instance, we had a friend of ours, her high school daughter. You can watch little geotags of your friends and you can watch live stream places you weren't invited to. And she said four of her friends came to her driveway and she saw their icons, but one of them didn't like her and convinced them all to leave. So she watched them almost come over and then leave. Like the pressures teenagers face, like every day of my life, I'm like, I'm so glad I didn't grow up with social media. Like I'm so grateful. And I didn't have an option for teenagers. But then I start to think, what if I did? But I knew if I wrote it, it would sound like an adult trying to sound cool. Like, hello, fellow youths. Like, oh, you use scooters a lot more than skateboards. And so I had my two teenage daughters write the book. Came out a couple weeks ago. It's called Your New Playlist. And it's to help teenagers with, okay, their mindset. Because imagine if they could learn that. We're not taught in school. 20 years ago, we weren't taught finances. 20 years ago, the high school plan was good luck with credit cards, good luck with debt, hope it works out. And now freshmen in high school have personal finance classes because we know we're equipping them. My hope is that we'll equip teenagers with mindset. I'd rather the teen learn it now than me have to repair it in a 48-year-old. Like there's power there because everybody has soundtracks. Now here's what's interesting. The best companies turn overthinking from a super problem into a superpower. The soundtracks become part of what drives their success. And they do it in three ways. They retire, they replace, they repeat. Now, this was about an hour. I did a three-hour version of this for FedEx, which was so much fun. It was a little awkward because they ordered books for everybody, which is great, but the publisher sent me the email with the tracking link to the FedEx corporate headquarters. And I clicked on the tracking link, and it was a UPS tracking link. Yeah, let me say that a different way. I UPS books to the FedEx corporate headquarters. A dude in a brown truck had to pull up to the FedEx security gate and be like, hey, I got some John Acuff books. He's a business expert, clearly. Where should I put them? I'm not familiar with your campus. And while I was speaking, I just see a pallet of my failure in the back. That was 3 hours. This has only been an hour. So what's next? That's always the question I get. What's next? And I'm a visual learner. I don't know if you like to learn visually. I like to learn visually. So I just commissioned an illustrator to take this entire keynote and turn it into a visual. Two different posters. One that walks you through, okay, how do you retire? How do you repeat? How do you replace? And the one that shows you the flow chart of the questions. Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? If you want a copy, just use that QR code. I'll send you a copy. And by the way, is there any technology that had a better comeback in the last 3 years than QR codes? Every bit of your communication should have a billion QR codes on it. The roof of your corporate headquarters should have one on the top so pilots can be like, snap, like everybody. QR codes are, anytime the entire country is taught how to use something, we should then use that in our communications. And every restaurant in America over the last 2 years taught people how to use QR codes. It's so fascinating to watch how communication changes, isn't it? But I'm so honored that I got to share with other communicators. I value what you do. I think it's amazing what you do. There's so many writers in here. There's so many people setting the tone for so many different companies. And I'm honored that I got to share a few ideas with you about building new soundtracks. And I can't wait to see what you do with them. Thanks, guys.